Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. In theory, empathy and the practice of medicine should be pretty closely linked, given the fact that doctors work in the ultimate caring profession. But chances are you've bumped into a doctor or two who has been anything but feeling and sympathetic as they've raced through their rounds at the hospital or even in their private offices. Dr. Danielle Ofri has written a new book on this topic that tackles this issue head on. One of her main points, empathy must ultimately be taught. Later on this hour, the world's fastest man over 75, he's from Kansas, and Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list. But first up, the emotions that doctors face. Dr. Danielle Ofri is the author of What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine, and the book deals with questions, you know, about how doctors deal with the pain and suffering they encounter, the loss of life, and the errors they make. Things I've all wondered about. She's an associate professor of medicine at New York University School of Medicine and has cared for patients at New York's Bellevue Hospital for more than two decades. And Dr. Welcome, it's a pleasure to have you today.
Thank you.
Why should I care how my doctors feel? Because in theory, all I'm really concerned about is getting better myself.
Well, if you think about it, you could probably type in your symptoms into a computer and probably get a reasonably accurate diagnosis. But for most of us, it's hard to imagine that we'd feel like we've been taken care of. It would be a very dissatisfying experience. So there's a lot that's involved in a doctor-patient or nurse-patient encounter beside the mere conveying of facts and diagnosis. And anytime you have two human beings interacting, there's always emotions that come into play.
You know, as I look at all this, though, you know, my experience with the medical system has been, it's been fairly positive, but I always look at the process as pretty emotionless on my part and on my doctor's part, too.
You know, again, if it were a computer doing it, it would be emotionless, but it's not. So your doctor, I mean, they're obviously all the emotions of the patient, and I'll put that aside for one moment. We know those are there. But the doctor, too, has reactions to the patient, to the situation. For example, if the previous patient that the doctor saw was very sick or had a patient had just died, well, the next patient they see, it's impossible to think those emotions will be completely put away, and they may certainly behave differently with the next patient after a tragic loss of a patient. So it does come into play.
No, you write in the introduction to this book, the emotional layers in medicine, however, are far more nuanced and pervasive than we may like to believe. In fact, you write, they can often be the dominant players in medical decision-making. Actually, the dominant players, doctor?
Well, sometimes. Imagine a case, I'll put in quotes, a difficult patient, a patient who has lots of complaints and issues and might be a little bit challenging or combative with the doctor. Doctors often aren't very skilled in dealing with these kind of patients and may have their own ire raised, often get angry, may not like the patient, even though that shouldn't matter, but it sometimes does come in. And I think when doctors are really angry and frustrated, they don't give the patient the full time they need. They aren't listening with their full attention. They may not be giving the full respect that's needed. And then maybe their care is a bit slipshod, or maybe they miss something or don't hear something. So it can, it shouldn't be the dominant, but it certainly can be the dominant emotion in certain encounters.
Let me get our listeners involved here. I'm betting they'll have something to say about all this, doctor. I'm wondering how empathetic are the doctors that you deal with in your lives every day? If you are a doctor or a nurse, do you buy this idea that your emotional state can at least sometimes wind up being the dominant player in your decision-making? And if you're a patient, do you expect much empathy and even sympathy from your doctor, or do you view it, as I do, as a pretty emotionless profession? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. You can also tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. That number again, 816-235-2888. You know, isn't, doctor, a big part of this lack of emotion due to the threat of lawsuits? Because, you know, a doctor is never going to say, you know, oh, man, I almost killed you in there, Sonny. I mean, you're never going to hear that.
Right, and I think the threat of lawsuits is clearly a reality. We can't pretend it doesn't exist. But what's interesting is often patients will react in the opposite direction that you've mentioned. If a doctor says, you know, something happened, in which I made a mistake, and this is what happened. It's my fault. Here's why it happened. I take responsibility. I apologize. Here's what I've done to make it better. For many patients, they're actually less likely to sue if they hear that from a doctor. I mean, most patients sue because they're angry or they haven't gotten information. It's often the key reason that patients sue. And many patients will say, if my doctor admits an error, I trust them more because now I know they'll be honest with me. Nothing will be hidden. So it can go both ways.
How often these days do you admit errors that you make in your rounds?
Well, I would say I've come a long way. When I was, you know, I've written more about errors that happened when I was younger in my training because at that time I didn't have the emotional wherewithal to admit an error, and I hid them. And because I was embarrassed and ashamed, worried about a lawsuit, but more than that, I was just so ashamed by the error and by how my, you know, not living up to my ideals that I couldn't come forward. But now when there is an error, I have told my patients. And remarkably, most of them respond very well. They are grateful to have honest information because I think that patients, and rightly so, don't trust the system very much and are much happier to know they're getting honest information, even if it contains an error.
Our phone number here again, 816-235-2888. We're visiting with Dr. Daniel Ofri, author of What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. You know, speaking of mistakes, you just told a terrific story in a column you wrote for the New York Times about a potentially fatal mistake you made a long time ago. It was midway through your medical residency. Walk us through that, doctor. What happened?
So I was a second-year resident in a chaotic. Every night on call was chaotic at Bellevue Hospital. And so we had an old patient from a nursing home who was a little more demented than she was yesterday. It seemed like a ridiculous admission. And we were able to, quote, turf the patient to the intermediate care unit. What happened, though, is I didn't check the CAT scan, which showed the patient had a bleed in their head, which could have accounted for the change in symptoms.
And this is a basic step you've got to take, right?
Right, to check everything before you transfer a patient. And I didn't do it maliciously. I was so busy with other patients, I was glad to have one less, and I had many more patients to admit. I think it was more of an oversight. And somebody caught it, luckily, so it wasn't missed. The patient was treated. But I was so horrified at the error that I told nobody. I didn't tell my supervisor. I didn't tell my team. I certainly didn't tell the patient or their family. And not until I wrote this op-ed some 25, 30 years later did I actually ever speak of it publicly because it was so humiliating for me and I felt so terrible about what had happened. And yet, at the time, if I had at least spoken to my supervisor, we could have talked about, boy, how did that error happen? How could we not make that again? And maybe it would have spared some other errors in the future. And then I should have spoken to the family and said, here's an oversight, an error that happened, and take responsibility. I think they would have been very relieved to hear that.
But so many families, you know, so many Americans, I guess, to be honest, you know, it seems to me these days would hear that a doctor has made a big mistake and think to themselves, aha, there's $1 million in my pocket.
You know, that is a stereotype, and there certainly are some people like that. But most patients don't want to sue. I think every patient knows, as well as every doctor, that a lawsuit is a horrible experience for everyone involved. And patients rarely win lawsuits in any case, and certainly it never, even if you win in quotes, you get some money, but you don't solve the error that happened. So for patients who've had tragic errors and terrible outcomes, the lawsuit won't undo that. And it's protracted, and for everyone's life it's horrible. So I think most patients would prefer not to sue. They'd rather see the problem solved, and they mostly want to be treated honestly, fairly, directly. I think that's the number one complaint.
Yeah. Well, before we go to some phone calls here, and this board has lit up very, very quickly today on this topic of doctors and empathy and what doctors feel. You know, lots of doctors make mistakes. Lots of journalists make mistakes. Lots of doctors cover them up and feel intense shame. So what needs to happen here? What needs to change in the profession to sort of shake it up here a little bit in the way you're talking about?
I think we have to acknowledge that the very first step is that doctors and nurses and students have to be able to come forward because, as you say correctly, many mistakes are never known because they're covered up, or the patient does okay or good enough, and so, you know, who needs to know? And that's an enormous iceberg of medical error. So we have to make it okay for doctors and nurses to come forward. And there's many things that come around that. So one, obviously, is trying to help protect them from lawsuits when they're not appropriate. But another big one is to make it a comfortable environment that they won't be shamed or humiliated or blamed or fired for making an error, because I think the hospital system has a vested interest in doctors coming forward. They want to know, they should want to know about the errors, not make it punitive. So I think addressing that issue is the number one thing.
What Doctors Feel is our topic today. Our guest, Dr. Danielle Ofri, her book, What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. Let's go to some phone calls here, and let's go to Dr. John from up in St. Joseph, Missouri. Doctor, good morning to you.
Good morning. What I want to say is that I'm a retired physician as a gastroenterologist in practice for 50 years. But when I was in medical school, my pathology professor said to us, it takes 10 to 12 years to train you to be a doctor. And another 10 or 15 years, you might become a physician. So the point is that in caring for people, you need to have a participatory conversation, not just an autocratic technical conversation. And today, most of the doctors have become technicians. A gastroenterologist has become a colonoscopist rather than a physician. He's looking at a patient through his colonoscope, not through at them as being a human being with a problem. And most of the decisions have to be made in a participatory manner, with patients making choices that are reasonable, guided by the physician's empathy for understanding what the process is, and to know the family and the milieu and all process, not just a colon to look at, not just a stomach to look at. You're a human being with many concerns, and this is my concern about today's medicine, where we ignore these situations to protect ourselves.
Dr. John, hang on just for a second. Danielle, you point out in this book that you found in your own experience, I guess with some surprise, that it was the older white male physicians you trained with at Bellevue Hospital who wound up modeling empathy for you. How did that happen?
Well, it's interesting, and I was making the parallel to, you know, cultural competence. We talk about that a lot, and yet most of my supervisors, my professors were older white men with bow ties and starched white coats. Yet when I watched them with our patients, who were by and large immigrants, lower socioeconomic patients, I couldn't imagine how they would connect to the patient or the patient would connect to them. Yet these doctors were so interested in the patient, in knowing everything about them. They took very long and careful histories, did very careful and detailed physical exams, were very respectful. But their whole attitude of clinical curiosity conveyed respect and empathy, and the patients cued into how much the doctors really wanted to know them and help them. And it didn't matter, they had nothing in common socially or economically, but the doctors really gave them the time and the space. And I think that's what a building block of empathy is.
Dr. John, I'm glad you called. Yeah, go ahead.
I would suggest one other thing. With empathy comes trust. And the biggest issue in our society today is a lack of trust.
Good phone call, doctor. Thank you for making it.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, Danielle, you tell an absolutely terrific story in the book about an experience you had as a first-year medical student when you were working as a rape crisis volunteer in the emergency room. And you came across a homeless woman who didn't smell all that good. And in fact, she had a cockroach crawling in and out of her clothing. You tell this story about how you responded to this with such great feeling. Tell us what you witnessed with this woman so many years ago.
Well, this is a few months into my first year of medical school, so I hadn't so much as seen a patient or been out of a classroom at all. And it was my first time being called to help a victim of sexual assault. And this patient was homeless, powerfully malodorous. And as I approached her, the smell was overwhelming. And then this roach crawled out, and I thought I would just lose it. And I couldn't get over my discomfort. I couldn't go up to her, and I just backed away, and I hid behind the desk pretending to do paperwork. And I was appalled at my inability. I thought, well, how will I ever be a doctor? Isn't my job to help a patient in need no matter what the situation? But then I watched an older nurse aide come by, and the nurse aide put her arm around the patient. She began to speak to the patient very gently, come, let me help you. Let's get you some clean clothes, get you washed up. You'll feel much better. And I knew that aide was smelling the same smell and touching the same, you know, awful clothing. And yet she gave of herself to the patient. And I watched the patient respond, stand up, walk with her, and they went down to the shower area. And that was my first object lesson in true empathy.
And I'm gathering that story has shaped you probably ever since.
It shaped me in many ways. One is to see someone model empathy is very different to hear about it in a lecture or a book. As I saw how it happened, that was a powerful experience. It also taught me the lesson that education comes from many places, not just your own professors, that the nurse aide or the orderly or the secretary or a family member, you know, may be the one teaching you lessons, and, of course, the patient, and that as students and as caregivers, we have to keep our eyes and ears peeled for lessons in any spot.
Well, I thought that was just a very, very powerful story. Again, our guest, Dr. Danielle Ofri. She's the author of What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. Back to some calls here. Lori from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go
ahead. Actually, my mother, and she is a she's a failure, and she had her initial surgery, her open heart surgery, over 25 years ago. She's in her 80s, and we have had the same cardiologist, or she has, and he has become really a member of the family. He knows every one of us. We all know him, and I think that with the great empathy that he has for her, and actually the love that he has for her, it's been like a mother-son relationship. She started with him when he was beginning. And I think sometimes it actually makes it more difficult. There's times where he doesn't address things that are tough with just my mom and dad. And when I come into town and I go with him to see him, he'll meet privately with me because it's almost as if he's not capable of presenting this tough news to my parents. Mm. So it can be... I think it can also be very, very different than what you're talking about. I think that empathy can become so deep, and the love for a patient can occur when you're talking about chronically ill or people that have been with doctors for a long time.
So she's become, the doctor's become too close.
I would say so, but yet, if he talked to my mother, she would never want to see anyone else.
That's really interesting.
But I worry about his care because he does not want to scare them or hurt their feelings because they're older.
Yeah. Danielle, what about that, this notion of becoming too close at times?
You know, that's an interesting thing. And obviously finding the balance is very important because there is a line where a doctor may lose their ability to care competently for a patient. I would say that overall, that's rarely reached. I think usually it's the other end that we worry about, that doctors are not invested enough.
Right.
And my mother's obviously lucky to have a doctor who cares so much. I guess what you might want to do is look at the clinical facts and maybe get a second opinion. Is the doctor not giving adequate care? If the second opinion says, I think the care is adequate, then maybe, you know, it's sufficient. The other thing to think about, you know, at this age is quality of life. Is very important. And having the security of a doctor who truly loves a patient, and you know, there are
that,
opportunities.
That is what we are up against. I mean, I don't think there is.
That may be what gives her the health in her life, that what another doctor may do maybe would give her, extend her life a little bit, but to be in an unfamiliar place or hospital may damage the quality of life. So it's a very tricky balance. I mean, if you have concerns that something is being missed that's very grave, second opinion is probably worth it. If it's an issue of, you know, on the edges, maybe, you know, where she's happiest is best.
Lori, go ahead.
No, that's great. I mean, I appreciate that. And I think the quality of life issue is the greater issue with kind of what we've decided. And it's myself and my family members who have to just stay very, very involved with him to ensure that all information is coming forward. And you know, we kind of have to, it's that whole thing with the cycle of life. Now we have to take a stronger role in our parents' care, and in my mother's right. in particular. But changing her doctor, I think, would be very difficult.
Right.
But it's put extra probably work forward because that relationship can become so close.
Yeah. Go ahead, doctor.
I think if you just get, make sure you have all the information and look at it maybe with either a friend who's a doctor or another physician that you, you know, engage, just evaluate the information, may give you a sense of if the care is sufficient.
Lori, thank you for the call. We're talking again with Dr. Danielle Ofori. Our topic today, how do emotions affect medical care? Our number here again, 816-235-2888, and our email address, UpToDate at kcur.org. Option three, tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. Mike from South Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning, Mike.
Yes. Yesterday I was talking to a wife of a doctor that does, that, you know, especially is cancer. And my question to her, I don't know him that well, but I think he's a very nice person. And my question was, how do you keep from, when you're treating cancer patients, how does a doctor keep from getting so much involved, you know what I mean, in every patient?
Great question, Mike. Doctor?
Okay.
Yeah.
There's actually been a lot of work with oncologist research because oncologists face so much death and dying more than most physicians, and they are powerfully affected by it. It's not so easy to compartmentalize death and grief because when someone dies, it is sad, and it should be sad. I think if we've lost the ability to feel sad when a patient dies, we've lost an important part of our skills and what makes us human. On the other hand, we have to find a way that it doesn't overwhelm us and affect our ability to treat other patients. So different places have experimented with weekly support groups, with mentors, you know, keeping an eye on doctors in training and nurses in training that they are handling this well. And I think providing space importance of acknowledging this is very important. I think when we don't acknowledge it and we just go on like nothing happened, then these emotions get bottled up, and it can have very powerful effects. So wise hospitals and practices allow time and space for doctors to process some of these emotions because they are very real.
Yeah, I think that's so important, and I wonder the same thing as our caller, Mike, does about sort of this continuous nature of these people coming at you all day. You know, many years ago when I first came to town, I covered the police department here in Kansas City, and, you know, by all means, I came to admire a lot of those guys because, you know, it was, you know, but it was also pretty hard to miss this idea that these were pretty hardened people. And doctors are working with the public in something of a similar manner, these people just coming at you all day. And I'm wondering, you know, how is it possible not to become hardened in a work world like the big city hospital you work in at Bellevue?
Well, there's also a lot of joy. It's not all bad. There's joy in sad times. For example, when a patient is dying and you help them make their death in their last few months as comfortable as possible, help them be where they want to be when they die. If they want to be at home, help make that happen, to make them pain-free, to avoid the procedures they don't want. For many patients, that's a very relieving experience. And for a physician, it's a very gratifying experience. The death will happen. But if you make the death dignified and comfortable and pain-free in a loving environment, that is a kind of joy. And I think about the patient, the woman who called before about her mother. It sounds like this doctor is making her, you know, final years very warm and secure, and that is a form of joy. So there is joy to balance the difficult times.
Again, we're talking about emotions in medicine. How do emotions affect medical care? How empathetic are the doctors you deal with in your lives? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. UpToDate at kcur.org is our email address. You can tweet us at kcurUpToDate. Lynn from Overland Park, good morning. You there, Lynn? You know, I'm also wondering, you know, the flip side of the coin, we're talking about the one patient who seems to enjoy her relationship with her doctor. But what about a patient, you know, who seemed to bring problems onto themselves? You know, Dr. Ofri, I'm thinking about Mr. Carello, if I'm saying that name correctly, from your book, an opiate addict who was admitted to Bellevue for the 57th time for a drug overdose. How is he dealt with?
It is very hard. I think doctors, their empathy reserves are at their lowest when it comes to patients with diseases that appear to be self-inflicted, such as drug use, alcoholism, obesity. And clearly there is personal, you know, involvement in there and self-control, but there are also many biological layers, economic layers. And yet, as physicians, we often only see the self-control part, and it makes us very, I think, angry, because we're used to being very much in control. And if, well, you're overweight, just eat less and exercise more. It's not quite so simple. If you're on drugs, just stop them. It's not so simple. So we have a lot of trouble empathizing and identifying with these patients. This was a man, he was a classic drug addict, you know, in and out of the hospital all the time. And I remember we were on rounds, and usually on rounds, the team chooses the most interesting or the sickest patient. I suggested we talk about Mr. Carello, arguably the most boring patient we had. But I dragged the team, and we'll learn something from this. And at first, it was a standard interview, one-word answers, oh, the history of being in jail and rehab, and very, very dispiriting. But then I thought of a question that I had never asked before. I asked Mr. Carello if he could take us to the moment that he knew he was addicted, when he went from the chapter of his life to being from being well to being addicted to drugs. And he could have told us exactly when that happened. He described the scene driving uptown on the Henry Hudson Parkway on the west side of Manhattan in the springtime off to his nephew's birthday party. And suddenly, he wanted a hit so badly, more than he wanted to see his beloved nephew, that he spun the car around and headed downtown to his dealer. And he said, it was as though God reached down a hand and flicked my car in the opposite direction. And I've been going downtown ever since. And when he told us that story, the room was pin drop silent. The team was riveted to this story, I think because we could suddenly imagine what it might feel like to have forces larger than us control our lives. And after that, people were much more respectful, came into his room more often, spoke to him more. He was much more friendly. And I won't, you know, delude myself to thinking that's going to solve his years of drug addiction. But it's hard to imagine how they'd be solved without empathy from his caregivers.
You know, it strikes me like it's almost important that doctors have interviewing skills. In theory, like me sitting here doing a daily talk show, asking the right question sometimes changes the whole nature of the game.
Oh, I mean, there's the whole art of the medical interview, which is in the speaking to patients and getting information about their disease. We actually call it an interview. And there are definitely skills, and many doctors do them much better than others. We do teach this in medical school, but it doesn't have the strongest emphasis. And one of my exercises sometimes when I'm on the wards, I ask the team, take me to the most difficult patient. And there's always the most difficult patient, someone refusing treatment or being very surly. And one of the things I ask the patient is, tell me what your passion or hobby is. What do you love to do? And everyone has something they love to do or used to love to do. And I found even the homeless guys from the Bowery can tell me something they love to do. And often that's a point of connecting that's separate from the illness and the CAT scan. And after that, we see them more as a real person, and they see us more as someone interested in them as a person, not just their illness. So you're right. Asking the right questions can make all the difference.
Yeah. Back to some phone calls here. Lynn from Overland Park. Lynn, you're on with Dr. Danielle Ofri. Good morning.
Good morning. And first of all, congratulations, doctor, on writing your book and addressing this issue.
Thank you.
It's really important. It's also important that I think doctors who are empathetic, but empathetic to the point where they know when not to press the emotional side of the issues, are important. They're geniuses. Because sometimes you really don't want anybody to be kind to you. Sometimes you're right on the edge.
Mm-hmm.
I was a paralegal for almost 20 years, and I've dealt with doctors as a patient, as a professional, in all kinds of situations, as you can imagine, and all kinds of doctors. And I can tell you the ones that get in trouble are the ones who don't give a rip or don't seem to. They say, oh, man, we had complications. I'm going on vacation. I'll see you next Tuesday.
Well, I think what you say validates what I mentioned, that most patients, I believe, sue because they feel like they haven't been treated honestly and with respect. And
that's
most
right.
Want information.
That's right. And if a doctor in that situation would come in and say, I am so sorry, I am scheduled to be out of town, we had a little trouble, here's what happened, this is, you know, Ralphie, he's going to take over, he's good, you'll like him, you know, it would go so much farther. But the empathy part, I have right now a doctor here in Overland Park who is absolutely a genius. I feel every time I see him that I am the only patient he has, and he's been just dying to see me, you know. I feel like I am the most important patient, and I know when he goes next door, that guy feels the same way. He remembers something individual about every one of his patients. I don't know whether he makes notes or whether he actually remembers them.
Yeah.
He knows when you need a boost and when to back off and leave you alone. His interviewing skills are tremendous. He's not, you know, full of sleazy charm. He's just a decent human being who can help you with all this.
Lynn, you're lucky. Yeah, I appreciate that. Let me grab one more phone call here quickly before a break. George from Kansas City, Missouri. George, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, Steve. I just wanted to say that I think that I think there's a real serious lack of compassion in the medical profession. I think the medical professionals are pretty overworked, but having dealt with a number of dying family members and taking care of sick kids and so forth, I find that it's extremely hard to get attention. It's extremely hard to get the kind of care that you'd like, the compassion, the follow-up, and, you know, even getting pain medicine for patients who clearly need it is a big deal because all the doctors are terrified to write prescriptions for pain medicine.
Right.
And I could probably go on for hours and hours, but I sort of think there's this myth of the doctor who's your best buddy and takes care of you and all that. I think that's extremely rare.
Right. George, thank you for the call. And just briefly, doctor, to wrap this up, I'm just wondering how seriously the medical profession is taking the thoughts and ideas you have in this book, or do they regard it as just another touchy-feely sort of kind of idea?
Well, I think things are changing. I think traditionally it has been the touchy-feely, you know, the add-ons. But I think people are realizing, like your prior caller had mentioned, what a difference it makes in the medical care that people get when the doctor does treat you with empathy. And research is now bearing out that patients of doctors who score better on tests of empathy have better outcomes with their glucose and cholesterol. So there are hard clinical outcomes which I think validate what we know in our gut, that most likely these doctors do a better job.
Dr. Daniel Ofri is the author of What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. Doctor, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
You bet. All the best.